Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, we're bringing you a special edition of the show from the Women in Agribusiness Summit. Nearly 1,000 women from 47 states and 12 countries are gathered in Denver for farm tours, networking, and deep diving in industry topics. We connected with experts to discuss the elections, Endangered Species Act, Climate Week, and economic challenges facing the Western U.S. But first, here's this week's headlines. The House and Senate passed a stopgap spending bill Wednesday to keep the government funded through December 20th. The continuing resolution includes an extension of authority for USDA's mandatory livestock reporting system and the Food for Peace program, as well as domestic food assistance. A bipartisan group of lawmakers are proposing to extend the new 45Z tax credit for low-carbon biofuels by 7 more years, but limit the incentive to products obtained from domestic feedstocks, like vegetable oils and corn ethanol. The 45Z credit will begin in January, but expires at the end of 2027. The value of the credit will vary depending on the carbon intensity of the fuel. Senators Roger Marshall and Sherrod Brown are co-sponsoring the Senate bill that would authorize the credit through 2034. Tracy Mann and Marcy Kaptur are co-sponsoring a companion bill in the House. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack has warned against restricting the tax credit to domestic feedstocks, saying that could provoke retaliation against American ag exports. The Conservation Reserve Program's land ranking and selection system could be updated to meet environmental and budgetary goals, according to a new Government Accountability Office report. The report says the Farm Service Agency is using modern, science-based information for scoring soil erosion, water quality, and air quality benefits. The report suggests using similar methods for weighing wildlife benefits and other scoring considerations, as well as improving its land selection methods. There are tight House and Senate races across the country that will decide which party controls Congress next year. We asked senior federal government relations lead at Syngenta, Mary Kay Thatcher, about her outlook for the Senate.
Well, certainly in the Senate, I think the Republicans have a leg up right now. I mean, it's pretty much a given that with Joe Manchin leaving West Virginia, that Governor Justice will win that. So that would put us at a 50-50 split. And, you know, I think Senator Tester in Montana is going to have a difficult time. Trump won that by a big amount a few years ago. And so it's looking very difficult. There are really more Democratic senators that are in tough races than there are Republican senators. In fact, really, other than Ted Cruz, it's pretty limited. So I think one would be pretty safe to go to Vegas right now and bet that the Senate turns Republican.
And what about a third of current House Ag Committee members are in races that are considered close? What's important to watch in those races, and how do you think that chamber shakes out come November?
Well, I'm really in hope that whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats, either one, that, you know, we don't have people who really care about agriculture losing a race simply because we didn't get the farm bill done. I think it's too bad that we didn't rally sooner as an industry and say, look, these are important people to help. Let's make sure we get them reelected, et cetera. As you well know, it's tougher and tougher. People in Washington not knowing agriculture, not understanding it, not appreciating it. So you always hate to lose good people. But, you know, when you look at it, there's about twice as many as in percentage of people on the Ag Committee that are in really tough races than there are in the House as a whole. So I think that says a lot.
How do you think a lack of a farm bill influences the campaigns of candidates in those close races, especially those in farm country?
Well, I don't think it did until the last couple of months. I mean, I'm not really sure that when you think about agriculture in general, that we really had a grasp in the country on how bad things were for a whole range of crops, for sure. And for that matter, you know, some of the livestock industry. So I think there's much more indication now of needing some help. But I think what people fail to remember is, even if we pass the farm bill right now, the actual increase in reference prices aren't going to get out there till October of 25. So this is not a short-term fix. And I suspect that's why you have several groups now calling for some kind of ad hoc disaster assistance for farmers suffering from a tough economy.
And this year, there are only about 50 House races in total that are considered close. What do you think has changed most about swing races and elections in general during your career?
Well, it's kind of amazing because there's all kinds of really interesting studies that talk about how people are moving to live near people who believe like them. So, you know, presumably a Republican doesn't want to go to a Sunday afternoon barbecue and have to debate politics with a Democrat who might be his next door neighbor. It's kind of amazing to me. And I'm not sure in agriculture we would totally understand that. But We really are getting way more, you know, Republicans in the middle part of this country, for that matter, and the Democrats on the outside. You look at the map not that many years ago, 2025, and it was a very red and blue everywhere map. And now it's kind of solid red and then blues for the most part. So I think it makes a big difference because it's harder and harder with gerrymandering, with campaign finance. I mean, you think about the amount of money. I visited with John Tester a few weeks ago, and you know, he was telling me that it'll probably be well over $300 a vote in Montana that they will spend between the Republicans and the Democrats in that Senate race.
Both presidential campaigns have touched on issues incredibly important to agriculture in rural America: trade, immigration, food prices, climate. What is the most important thing for agriculture to know about and watch with each candidate's platform?
Well, I think with both candidates, we have to continue to talk about trade and the importance of trade, because we do still export 20-25% of what we grow. And, you know, for some commodities, 60% or 70%. And we're suffering in that market right now. We need to get back to having more free to trade agreements that really cut tariffs, besides just trade agreements that go in and try to fix sanitary and phytosanitary barriers. Certainly those are important, too. But tariff reduction would be a big thing. And then I think the other thing for agriculture to keep really involved in very soon after 2025 starts is this big tax bill that has to be done. These are major tax changes that were made in 2017 and will have a huge impact on farmers, all the way from estate taxes to capital gains to individual rates to 1099 or 199 deductions, etc.
We'll be right back with more from Mary Kay right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Biodiesel is clearly the lowest cost, fastest to market product. If we started to make a change to low blends to high blends today, we're going to impact clean air right now instead of waiting for a new technology. We are for innovation. So let's innovate. I don't know what's coming 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, but I know today our fuels can clean the air.
Welcome back. EPA has been working on strategies to reduce the use of pesticides in endangered species habitat. We asked Mary Kay Thatcher from Syngenta, what has farmers worried about these strategies?
Unfortunately, I don't think farmers are as worried as they should, other than leadership in some of the groups, because these regs, they are so complex. But farmers need to be worried, because unfortunately, court suits mean that we have to make sure that EPA is not approving pesticides that might harm an endangered species. And so the way that they're getting around this just is to say farmers would have to do upfront mitigation practices for maybe 4 to 15 years until the Fish and Wildlife Service determines whether or not the pesticide is a problem. So it's going to be more contour plowing, larger buffer strips, less use of a pesticide, etc. And then, you know, where we may come from, Lydia, is 5 years from now, may find out that pesticide isn't a problem, and the farmers have had to pay all this additional cost to be able to produce. So while anybody and everybody knows we have to fix this problem with endangered species, we got to make sure we got really good maps that are only making us do these things if we truly have an endangered species in that area. We got to use the best science. And then maybe one of the biggest things is we got to get EPA to really dummy this down, because if you look at how hard it's going to be for a farmer to figure out what do I do on this field, what do I do on this, what kind of pesticide am I thinking, what kind of drift am I going to have over here, the decisions are going to be insurmountable. And think about trying to do that out in a field where there's no internet access.
And that comes when we're already in a really challenging farm economy. What kinds of costs, you know, broad cost, when can farmers expect from having to make some of those transitions?
Well, you even look at just something as simple as a buffer strip. I mean, we have some proposals that are looking at buffer strips of maybe an extra 100 yards to 300 yards. It could be, you know, 20% of that piece of land, that field. You think about an individual field and then happen to put a buffer strip around it, you could lose 20% of your production value. So that's maybe one of the easiest things to think about, but cover crops aren't cheap. Putting in tiling is not cheap. So it's going to be a very expensive proposition. And we have to make sure, again, that we know we have to protect endangered species. We know we have to do this in agriculture, because if we don't, the enviros will continue to sue us and we'll continue to lose pesticides one by one by one.
Are you meeting with the EPA, and what have those dialogues looked like to modify the way that they implement these strategies and the way they plan to implement them in the future?
Well, you know, one of the first ones that came out was what's called the herbicide strategy, and we think they've made really good progress towards understanding farmers' concerns, et cetera. So it's looking better, but now we have an insecticide strategy out. It was 700 pages long. The comment period just ended last week, I think. And it looks to me like while they took into consideration some of the things that we suggested in the herbicide strategy, there's still lots of things outstanding that they didn't. So after this, we're going to have a rodenticide strategy. We're going to have a fungicide strategy, et cetera. So this is an ongoing thing. EPA is very pushed to get this done by a certain time. And I suspect EPA is also very pushed to want to do this by the election in case we have a different president.
And EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs is struggling with a limited budget. Has industry made it clear that the Office of Pesticide Programs needs more resources?
We absolutely have. And you can imagine, you go to the Hill and, you know, whether it's a farm group or whether it's a registrant like us, and you say, give EPA more money. And Republicans are like, what are you talking about? So it's a challenge to say, look, we're just asking for more money for the Office of Pesticide Programs so that indeed they can help us move along some of these registrations. Because I think in general, the registrations you're getting for new pesticides are going to be much safer pesticides than what we had registered 40 years ago, et cetera. And now it's just a very long process. It's like 12 or 13 years. So we'd all like to get that done. And we've also been lobbying for more money for the Fish and Wildlife Service, for National Marine Fisheries, again, on this whole Endangered Species Act to get them funding.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next farm bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this farm bill coverage.
Welcome back. Taryn Lawrence is the Chief Sustainability Officer for Rabobank North America. We asked her about her experience at Climate Week.
There was a lot of energy, and the food system transition was something high on the list of things to talk about. So I went to several events specifically around how we improve the state of agriculture globally, with certainly a heavy focus also on more developed markets.
Tell me a bit about the sessions. What discussions did you have about dairy?
I think that was one of the discussions that I found most exciting, because we moved beyond ideation and into concrete next steps. One of the most important parts of that conversation was that we had dairy producers in the room. We can sit as a financial institution or a corporate and say, we think this is going to work. But until we say, will this work, to the person who actually would implement a practice, it doesn't work. So we had excellent conversations with producers, off-takers, people within the dairy space on how we move this forward collectively for the good of the industry.
You have extensive experience in the sustainability and climate space. How have you seen those discussions change throughout your career? And how have you seen agriculture's involvement in events like Climate Week change over time?
Yeah, certainly. I think there's now an understanding around the importance of greenhouse gas disclosures and focus, but there is a shift towards the inclusion of nature. What's your water availability? How is your ecotoxicity, your soil quality, your biodiversity? So sustainability is expanding beyond one metric, but it also includes people. It also includes animal welfare. It includes so many metrics beyond carbon. And I was really pleased to see a more holistic approach to what sustainability means versus a singular focus on one metric.
From your perspective, what is the biggest way farmers can financially benefit from the practices that they implement?
Well, I think it's up to innovators, financiers, CPGs to make the economics of sustainability initiatives work first. We can't rely on subsidies, grants, philanthropic capital on an ongoing basis. Now, those certainly play a critical role in catalyzing these innovations, but the economics have to work. And oftentimes, what's exciting about sustainability is efficiency and sustainability go hand in hand, which is often linked to cost reduction. So I think when I talk about sustainability as a farmer, I always tell my colleagues, think like a farmer. They're thinking in generations. They're not thinking in quarters. And that's what we as corporates and financial institutions need to do.
You've worked extensively on carbon markets during your career. Can you explain the state of carbon markets now and how agriculture should best engage in that space going forward?
There has been a big shift from carbon credits and carbon markets and into carbon insetting. So what I mean by that is if you're a dairy producer and you invest in a methane digester, we want to keep that innovation and that investment within the supply chain because we want to be able to say, look at what dairy holistically is doing. If those credits are sold outside of the value chain, then we can't count it as a lower intensity product. So through the insetting process, if we can collectively fund the innovation that benefits the farmer and also the entirety of the supply chain, then we can take back the narrative. Agriculture can be a really powerful force for good, and keeping those innovations within the system is something I'm really passionate about.
From a policy perspective, what are the biggest asks? What's working well right now? And then what do you think the industry could use in the future to kind of accelerate the adoption of some of these things?
I mean, anything to support innovation, catalytic capital, any sort of grants, they are fantastic to get started. But I also think regardless of policy, the economics first, they have to work. These things have to work for farmers, regardless of political party, regardless of ideology, economics, generational resilience. That's what we need to focus on.
And Taryn, what's your message that you're sharing here with attendees at the Women in Agribusiness Summit?
I think agriculture is such a good fit for women. And it's something that most women aren't necessarily drawn to immediately. I will say the women that I have met in the industry are passionate. They're engaged. Women are nurturers. We want to take care of things. We want to grow things. That's agriculture. That's agribusiness.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us, Taryn.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Biodiesel is clearly the lowest cost, fastest to market product. If we started to make a change to low blends to high blends today, we're going to impact clean air right now instead of waiting for a new technology. We are for innovation. So let's innovate. I don't know what's coming 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, but I know today our fuels can clean the air.
Welcome back. Fidela Irigoyen is a West Agribusiness Market Executive at Wells Fargo. She says Western farmers are facing many economic challenges right now.
Two of the economic issues that we're seeing are related to water and labor. From the water perspective, as everybody knows in the West, there's a scramble. But I can say from a bank perspective, as a banker, what we like to see in our producers and growers is a couple of water sources, availability to a couple of water sources, so that if one is not available, there is something else as a backup. Creates a lot of stress. It's not inexpensive. Some of the water districts raising fees to cover some of the improvements that they need to make, which then ultimately gets passed on to the producer. The second economic issue that we are seeing across our entire portfolio is related to labor. And they're always coming up with new solutions. There's a little bit of mechanization that goes on, But I think one of the programs that is most beneficial is the H2A program, where individuals come from foreign countries for a period of time to match the grower's season. And then the benefit for them is they get to go home for an extended period of time to be with family. So those are the two areas that we see across our entire portfolio in terms of impact, that it's constant, always looking for new solutions.
We're also in a growing ag trade deficit, with much of the growing imports being fresh fruits and vegetables. What's causing this transition, and are you concerned about the lack of progress on new trade deals?
Much of the offshore growth in producing a lot of our fruits and vegetables is related to the labor component. Finding labor is difficult, particularly in California. There is, in addition to the labor, there's looking for housing for the workers. That also is very difficult. And the other piece of it is growing product across in other countries is also beneficial to those countries. It provides a labor supply, a labor source for them. And it also gives us the fruits and vegetables that we are looking for.
We'd be remiss to talk about agriculture in California without discussing water issues. Can you explain the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and how that plays into growers' decision-making? What can the state do to ensure sustainable water supply for farmers?
So the program is designed to manage the underground water that is available and trying to be equitable with all of the different water districts. It's not an easy task. Each water district is having to come up with a plan for sustainability and how they're going to manage the water that is available and how it's allocated. So it is a challenge.
How have you seen the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act affect land values?
I would say in areas where there is not as much water, your land values are being impacted in reduced valuations. But I feel there's another phenomena going, not just with the water, but in the type of crops that have been planted through the years. For example, permanent crops, tree nuts, there's an abundance of them. And so that probably has been a more adverse economic impact to growers because there are so many and it has created depressed pricing.
And I see that you're on the board for the California Ag Leadership Foundation and a past participant yourself. A new class was recently announced. Can you explain a little bit about what the program is and what you hope participants take away?
Yes, the California Ag Leadership Program was very pivotal in my life when I went through it many, many years ago. It takes individuals that are in agriculture across the state of California and exposes them to things that impact them, the economic side of things, trade, politics, and brings 24 individuals across the state together who in some cases don't know what is grown in Southern California versus the central part of the state and northern part of the state. The first half is focused on national impact, and then the second half is focused on international. So the class takes a trip generally to a region of the United States to learn about agriculture in that area and just some of the social economic impacts that that region might have. And then they spend a week in Washington, D.C., meeting with the politicians and those that are involved in helping develop policy and the laws that govern us. The second half is what I found very intriguing is the international trip. For example, my class went to Japan, Korea, China, and Hong Kong. And it was, for me, it was Asia. But once you go to the individual countries, you realize that each one of them has their own personality, their own customs, their own way of doing things. And that was very eye-opening for me.
We'll be back with a look at the week ahead right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Welcome back. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. Both chambers of Congress are out of session until after the November election. Both chambers will return on November 12th. Vice presidential candidates Tim Walz and J.D. Vance will debate on Tuesday. And finally, USDA's monthly dairy products report comes out on Friday. As always, stay tuned for the latest on this and more at agripulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is agripulse.com.